May our renewed sense of what Thanksgiving is help us make this most American of holidays more meaningful to us as Jews. And may the extraordinary example of America's earliest Jews inspire us not only on Thanksgiving, but throughout our lives.
The Tikva Fund presents Jewish Ideas and the American Founders. Jewish Ideas and the American Founders is dedicated by Alan K. Schwartz in memory of his wife, Barbara R. Schwartz, and in tribute to all Jewish Americans, both strangers and neighbors, and is supported by the Zahava and Moshe L. Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought at Yeshiva University.
Rabbi Soloveitchik, in this fifth lecture in our course, we're going to spend some time with President Washington in the New Republic and meet some extraordinary figures of the Jewish community. Who are some of these people we're going to meet?
The main figure we're going to meet from the Jewish community is Gershom Mendes Seishas, who is my predecessor. He is known by many as the Patriot Rabbi of the Revolution. He preached ardently in favor of the Revolution, flees to Philadelphia, becomes the spiritual leader of the reconstituted community there under the title Mikveh Israel, then returns to New York, and there he engages in several extraordinary acts unlike that which any Jewish spiritual leader, I think, in history engaged in before, certainly in the diaspora. The first that he does is that he actually participates in George Washington's inauguration. In the procession.
Held in New York.
His inauguration. He is part of the party that greets Washington. Washington has a somewhat monarchical and royal inauguration. And I would make the claim, and I may be wrong, but it sounds right, that this was the first time that a Jewish spiritual leader had participated in the inaugural celebration of a head of state since the fall of Jerusalem. He then, in 1789, after George Washington issues the first National Thanksgiving Proclamation, creates an entire Thanksgiving ritual for Sheret Israel, which is in practice to this day, which involves the saying of Hallel, of some of the psalms from the service done traditionally on Rosh Chodesh, new moons, and holidays, and creates an entire service giving thanks to God, not, as is said in the story of the pilgrims, for the harvest, but for the Constitution. This is really thanks for the Constitution. There are also other Jews that we will meet. And these Jews will figure in events that take place before Washington's inauguration, during the debate over ratification of the Constitution. Because the Constitution was not a done deal when it was produced by the Constitutional Convention at all. And indeed, there's a whole group of very prominent Americans who were very much opposed to the Constitution. The question of the Constitution divided revolutionaries against revolutionaries and heroes of the Revolution against heroes of the Revolution. One of the most prominent opponents of the Constitution was Patrick Henry. Because he thought that it would reduce the very liberty that he had fought for in the first place. But the Jews, by and large, were in favor of the Constitution. And so we will see them in parades take place both in defense and support of the Constitution and in celebration of the vote in favor of the ratification of the Constitution. We will meet Jonas Phillips's son, who attends one of these parades. And as a Jew is apt to do, describes not only the parade, but the food that follows the parade. And we will meet Jews in New York, in the Sheret Israel community, who very ardently want to participate in a parade in support of the Constitution, but can't do so because it's been scheduled on a fast day. In the weeks ahead, many American Jews will mark two very different holidays, one as Americans and one as Jews. One is Thanksgiving and the other is Hanukkah. One is celebrated by Americans of many faiths the other by Jews all around the world. As such, this dual celebration reflects the complex nature of American Jewish identity, what it means to be both an American and a Jew. And there is, to my mind, no better embodiment of this dialectic than the star of one of my favorite Only in America stories. And that is the story of Mikey the Jewish dog. For those not familiar with the tale, I will repeat it now. Several years ago, the New York Times reported how in Helena, Montana, Rabbi Chaim Brook of Chabad showed up on Hanukkah at the state capitol in December for a menorah lighting. He was briefly checked out by an officer and by a bomb-sniffing dog, both of whom followed him into the rotunda for the ceremony. During the lighting, Rabbi Brook noted that, quote, "the dog sat at attention, watching the ceremony, with a peculiar expression on its face, a look of intense interest." After the ceremony, the police officer came over to Rabbi Brook and said to him, "Hello, my name is Officer Foskett. Do you mind if I ask you a few questions?" Apparently, the officer's dog, whose name was Mikey, had been raised from puppyhood in Israel, where he was trained as a bomb-sniffing dog by the IDF. When the Helena Police Department discovered that it was cheaper to import an Israeli dog rather than spend $20,000 training an American bomb dog, Mikey made Yurida and joined the Helena Police Force. But the problem, the officer explained, was that Mikey had been trained entirely in Hebrew. And so when Officer Foskett got Mikey, he was handed a list of a dozen Hebrew commands like Yishaer, Chapes, and Kelev Tov. But Mikey was not responding. Officer Foskett, not being Jewish, suspected that he wasn't pronouncing the words properly and that he needed a rabbi. And so, concludes the New York Times article, Rabbi Brook is now on call to work with Mikey and his owner as needed. Officer Foskett has since learned to pronounce the Hebrew ch sound, and Mikey has become a new star on the police force. So all is well in the Jewish community here in Montana, because the Hasidic rabbi is helping the Montana cop speak Hebrew to his dog. It is good news all around, says the article. The officer keeps the capital safe, and the Hebrew pooch is feeling more at home hearing his native tongue. And the big winner, writes the Times, is the rabbi, who has been scouring the state of Montana for anyone who can speak Hebrew and is elated to have finally found a German shepherd he can talk to, end quote. Now, let us ponder for a moment what exactly is so significant about this story. Mikey the dog is eager to help the citizens of his new land, but on his own terms, maintaining his own identity. In this, he is not unlike the star of the Torah readings that is read during Chanukah, Yosef, who saves civilization from starvation, but he does it as a Hebrew, refusing to relinquish his own identity. Ki ganov gunavti me'eretz ha'ivrim. The Jew is called to always model Yosef, to be aware of his origin, his uniqueness, to proclaim his loyalty to his ancestors and to their faith, while at the same time, he must be dedicated to the world. We are, as Rav Soloveitchik once wrote, exactly as Abraham identified himself, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. We are gerim, strangers, placed apart by our unique calling and destiny, but we seek also to be simultaneously toshavim, dedicated citizens of society. I have argued throughout my lectures on America that it is this ability to be both that is the essence of the unique Jewish experience in the United States. And today I will attempt to show how a reflection on the Jewish experience in America and the impact of biblical ideas on America allows us to understand what Thanksgiving is truly about. So we begin on September 25th, 1789. The Constitution had only recently been ratified. George Washington had been sworn in as the first president of the United States several months earlier. Now the House of Representatives, meeting right here in Manhattan, was preparing to adjourn its very first session, thereby making American history. Suddenly, Representative Elias Boudinot of New Jersey rose and made a proposal, and I quote from the Annals of Congress. Mr. Boudinot said that he could not think of letting the session pass over without offering an opportunity to all the citizens of the United States, of joining with one voice in returning to Almighty God their sincere thanks for the many blessings he had poured down upon them. With this view, therefore, he, the congressman, would move the following resolution. Resolved that a joint committee of both houses be directed to wait upon the President of the United States to request that he would recommend to the people of the United States a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many signal favors of Almighty God, especially by affording them the opportunity peaceably to establish a constitution of government for their safety and happiness, end quote. Which means, my friends, that Thanksgiving as a national holiday was first proposed not as a remembrance of the pilgrims or the Mayflower, but rather to express gratitude to God for the creation and ratification of our country's constitution. And this proposal, gratitude for the undertaking that was the American Constitution, should seem uncontroversial. Who wouldn't want to have a national day of thanksgiving for that? And yet, Boudinot's proposal was anything but uncontroversial. As Melanie Kirkpatrick put it in her write-up of this moment, his resolution actually sparked a vigorous debate within the First Congress of America. We might find this strange. And so in order to explain, we must place ourselves in their shoes. We have to seek to understand Congress's concerns. And that is that actually many congressmen did not want to thank God for the ratification of the Constitution, because at this point they were not all that sure that the ratification of the Constitution was something to celebrate, something for which gratitude must be given. At the same time, there is no question that there was one subset of American citizenry that was already thankful for the Constitution, and this was America's Jews. If we do not understand all of this, we cannot comprehend what the essence of Thanksgiving actually is. In order to truly comprehend what Thanksgiving is all about, we must first review the events of the 2 years preceding this congressional debate in 1789, which we will do from both an American and a Jewish perspective. We will then return to this congressional debate over Thanksgiving and then describe what exactly happened next. It was 2 years earlier, in 1787, that a convention that met in Philadelphia composed a new constitution that sought to form a more perfect union for we the people. This constitution was submitted for ratification to the 13 states, which were asked to approve a system of government that would transform this once loose confederation of former colonies into a veritable empire, the largest republic that the world had ever known. And in the proposed office of president, they would create an executive more powerful than the King of Great Britain. For that reason, many Americans, known as Anti-Federalists, which included some of the most revered of its patriots, opposed ratification as a threat to their liberty. In the debate over ratification that took place in Virginia, Patrick Henry, Lion of the Revolution, debated Madison, one of the fathers of the new document. And Henry argued that the Constitution was a violation of everything for which he had fought. And he said, quote, "When the American spirit was in its youth, the language of America was different. Liberty, sir, was the primary object. You," he said to Madison, "make the citizens of this country the subjects of one great consolidated empire of America. It squints toward monarchy," end quote. These were powerful words, so much so that Thomas Jefferson counseled Madison during this debate that the only thing to do when confronted by the power of Patrick Henry's rhetoric was to, quote, "devoutly pray for his imminent death," end quote. The debate that raged in Philadelphia was paralleled throughout all the states and has been documented in Pauline Meyer's magisterial book, Ratification. The Jews of New York and Philadelphia, as far as we can tell, were wholeheartedly on the side of Madison's new system of government. And for them, there was an additional incentive beyond that of forming a more perfect union, because in this new constitution was a remarkable clause that had existed in no governmental system up to this time, banning any religious test for federal office. Only months before the Constitutional Convention took place, as we've discussed in previous lectures, a Jew of Philadelphia and originally of New York by the name of Jonas Phillips had written to George Washington and the Constitutional Convention, complaining that devout Jews were unable to serve in the Pennsylvania legislature due to a Christian oath that was required. And he asked that all faiths be put on an equal footing in America. And now, with the Constitution, a polity was being proposed that did just that. And so, as every state proceeded to vote on ratification, the Jews both advocated in the affirmative and celebrated when their respective state had accepted this new system. Thus, in the summer of 1788, a parade was held in Philadelphia celebrating Pennsylvania's ratification, and the Jews of Philadelphia were very public participants in this procession. We have two remarkable recollections of this parade, one from a Christian and one from a Jew. And both, each in its own way, reflect the potential for Jews in America to be simultaneously ger and toshav, simultaneously engaged in civic affairs without sacrificing their open Jewishness. The first recollection is from a Christian, Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration, who attended and noted something that struck him. The clergy of the different Christian denominations with the rabbi of the Jews walking arm in arm. Rush reflected that this was, quote, a most delightful sight. There could not have been a more happy emblem contrived of that section of the new Constitution which opens its powers and offices alike, not only to every sect of Christians, but to worthy men of every religion. This is Benjamin Rush. This is the Christian recollection. Meanwhile, a Jew who was there also recounted what struck him most. This man was Naftali Phillips, Jonas Phillips' son, who was 15 years old at the time of the parade. And he wrote a recollection of this procession on October 24th, 1868, 80 years later, when he was 96 years old. Phillips describes in this letter, as a 96-year-old man, in intricate detail, all the floats and the professions and the trades that took part in this Philadelphia parade. I quote excerpts. He says, first, in an open carriage drawn by elegant horses sat Chief Justice McCain, with other judges of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, holding in his hand the new Constitution. This was received by the populace with great rejoicing. Then each profession had their own floats. So he writes, then came farmers with large cattle and sheep on a platform drawn by horses. The farmers were sowing grain as they walked along. Then came a handsome ship, elegantly adorned with flags, manned by young midshipmen, drawn by horses on wheels. Next, a printing press on a platform, drawn by horses, compositors setting types, and the press worked by journeymen distributing some printed matter as they went along. Next came blacksmiths with their forge, with a large bellows keeping up a blast to keep alive the flame of liberty. And then he writes, then followed three fine-looking men dressed in black velvet, with large wigs on, densely powdered, representing the hairdressing society. These were the Schetelmachers of Philadelphia. Then, the various trades, he writes, followed with their appropriate insignia. The procession then proceeded, and here comes the most amazing part. The procession then proceeded from about 3rd Street near Spruce, northward toward Callowhill Street, then wheeled toward Bush Hill, where there was a number of long tables loaded with all kinds of provisions, with a separate table for the Jews, who could not partake of the meals from the other tables. But they had, and now he describes, he remembers, what the food was on the kosher table. But they, meaning the Jews, had a full supply of soused salmon, that's pickled salmon, bread and crackers, almonds, raisins, etc. There was no spirituous liquor for the company. Having done full justice to the good things provided for, the procession then retrograded. It was the last I saw of them. He continues, I reached home late in the afternoon, fatigued and hungry. My kind good parents having provided a good meal for me, I retired to rest and knew nothing till I saw the sun shining in my room the next morning. Now, what is amazing about this? Several things. First, even in 1788, Jews understood that any celebration had to have locks, okay? That itself is interesting. Second, what is incredible is that this 96-year-old Jew, remembering something that takes place 80 years ago, recalls with intricate detail every bit of food that was served here. Benjamin Rush, the Christian, oh, a rabbi and a minister. You don't find that in Naftali Phillips' letter. There was food and the kosher table and it had this, etc. I also like that in the true Jewish fashion, even though there was kosher food that was served, which presumably he had some, but by the time he gets home, he's starving, right? This is like the people who show up in shul at 3:30 on Shabbos, right after they've just eaten, and there's like, ooh, shalashudas, day-old egg salad, fantastic. Okay, and they start eating. But all jokes aside, We have to pause to ponder how remarkable this was, how utterly impossible it would have been for anything remotely like this to take place in Europe. It is quite probably the first time that a separate kosher table was provided at a public civic celebration anywhere on earth in the history of the world. Meanwhile, the support of the Jews of New York for the proposed constitution was also acknowledged by Gentile New Yorkers, and in an even more remarkable way. In July of 1788, New York's convention gathered to vote on ratification. A parade in support of the Constitution, organized in order to urge the convention to vote yes, was scheduled on July 22nd, and then suddenly rescheduled to the next day. This has been documented in a wonderful article and commentary by Michael Schwartz, and I quote passages from his piece. He writes that there was an announcement that appeared in the New York Daily Advertiser on July 17th, reporting that the procession is postponed till Wednesday the 23rd, and the announcement, he writes, gives no reason for the postponement from the previously announced Tuesday the 22nd. The explanation comes in a letter dated July 16th to Nicholas Lowe, a wealthy New York City merchant from one of his agents, Peter Collin. Collin reported, quote, "It is said that the procession is postponed till the 23rd in order to give the Jews an opportunity to join in the festivals, the 22nd being one of their holidays." Another Jew from Staten Island wrote to his brother, "I observe the grand procession is put off to the 23rd. I think it is a great compliment paid the Jews," end quote. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we know that there is no Jewish holiday in July, okay? So what is this? A scan of the halakha calendar of 1788 reveals that July 22nd was Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, a minor fast day. All this postponed, so several hundred Jews that lived in New York at the time could mark this day of mourning and then participate in the parade. As Schwartz writes, a great compliment paid the Jews indeed it was, because it could not have been a simple or risk-free course to postpone the procession further after all the earlier false starts, even by a single day. Furthermore, he notes, the procession itself required extensive preparations. It was to be a huge event in which representatives of 60-odd trades and professions, roughly 5,000 people, were to participate. All this rescheduled, it was made into what we halakhic Jews would call a nidcha, okay? Just so Jews could observe Shiva Asar B'Tammuz. New York's ratification of the Constitution hangs in the balance. The minimum states required for ratifying the convention had already approved. But as he notes, Schwartz notes, if the Constitution was not approved by New York, then New York would have been essentially an independent country, right smack in the middle, dividing New England from the southern states. So the stakes could not have been higher. And yet, this great compliment was paid the Jews. I don't know what is more fascinating, that the New Yorkers, with the future of America hanging in the balance, were willing to make accommodations for Shiva Asar B'Tammuz for the Jews, or, I think this is even more striking, that New York's Jews at the time cared so much about observing Shiva Asar B'Tammuz that they sought that the parade be rescheduled, and that they cared so much about participating in the parade. Either way, it is a significant symbol of what constitutional America would mean for the future of American Jewry. In the end, as we know, the Federalists, not the Anti-Federalists, carried the day, and the Constitution was ratified by all 13 states. George Washington was elected the first president. Washington arrived in New York, then the capital of the country, to be sworn in. Here, too, the pluralistic approach to religion was front and center. Washington's speech, written in collaboration with Madison, refrained from doctrinal assertions. The inaugural procession featured 14 clergymen from New York, 13 Christians, and my predecessor, Gershom Mendes Seisha's spiritual leader, Sherith Israel. This, I believe, was the first time that a Jewish religious figure had played a ceremonial role in the installation of a head of state since the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Washington's inauguration also celebrated the cohesiveness of the country while simultaneously emphasizing Americans' freedoms. He suggested that the recent ratification of the Constitution, which peacefully united Americans without aligning their differences, was itself a miracle. This event surely brought great joy to the Jews, this inauguration in which their own spiritual leader participated. But for those who were anti-federalists, for those who had lost, and for other Americans who were worried about the power of the new presidency, there was much about Washington's inauguration to worry them. There were aspects of the 1789 ceremony that would seem more appropriate for a coronation rather than an elected leader's inauguration. Washington arrived at Manhattan's Federal Hall in a magnificent carriage pulled by 6 white horses. Washington strode into the Senate chamber wearing white silk stockings and a ceremonial sword. He was sworn in by New York Chancellor Robert Livingston, who administered the oath of office, and then he proclaimed to the crowd, "Long live George Washington, President of the United States." Now, of course, no one dared challenge Washington personally, but many of those who had opposed or at least been quite worried about the Constitution and the power of the chief executive, these people became members of Congress. And so in this nascent national government, the concerns of Patrick Henry were not isolated to Virginia. Many of the representatives were still worried that their newly created country embodied the European tyranny that they had fought so hard to erase. And so there were therefore many who were not all that excited about giving gratitude to God for the Constitution and were wary of asking the president to express these sentiments on behalf of a nation as if he were a European monarch.
And could you connect this instinct to Thanksgiving back to the instinct for worshiping that we tried to wrestle with in the previous lecture?
That's right.
There's something profound in human nature which wants to express gratitude.
So to me, one of the most interesting things about this story is the congressional debate over Thanksgiving, which I mentioned in the lecture. It's very striking because Thanksgiving is, I think today, probably the most beloved. I don't even think it's controversial. I think it's probably the most beloved national holiday in the United States. And so when we hear that actually the concept of a national Thanksgiving holiday was controversial and was actually debated vociferously in Congress, that to us is surprising. And the most striking thing to me is that one of the defenses given for it was from Roger Sherman, who notes that this is basically America's Hanukkah. That just as Solomon had a dedication of the temple, they need a dedication of the Constitution. And what that says in part, and this is really Judaism's genius, is that rituals are important. And thus, after Congressman Boudinot made his Thanksgiving proposal, the debate began. Representative Adonis Burke of South Carolina argued that, quote, he did not like this mimicking of European customs, where they made a mere mockery of Thanksgivings. Another Southerner, Representative Tudor Tucker, chimed in with similar sentiments, saying, quote, why should the president direct the people to do what perhaps they have no mind to do? They may not be inclined to return thanks for a constitution until they have experience that it promotes their safety and happiness. If a day of Thanksgiving must take place, he said, let it be done by the authority of the several states. And so Thanksgiving from the very beginning was not well received by the Congress, and it was under attack. At that moment, the Thanksgiving proposal was defended by one of the most widely unappreciated and underappreciated of the American founders, Roger Sherman. Sherman was one of the great men to represent Connecticut in Congress, but his biography has been forever maligned by the otherwise magnificent musical 1776. As many of you familiar with the Broadway version or film will know, Roger Sherman character, when asked by John Adams to perhaps compose the Declaration, famously responds, Mr. Adams, dear Mr. Adams, I cannot write with any style or sense of etiquette. I cannot tell a participle from a predicate. I am just a simple cobbler from Connecticut, end quote. This is a calumny, ladies and gentlemen. Roger Sherman may have had no formal schooling, and he may have been, as historians note, quote, the most ungainly looking person on God's earth, end quote. But he was also one of the few to have signed both the Declaration and the Constitution. And it was he who actually crafted the Connecticut Compromise that made the House and Senate and allowed the Constitution to come into existence. The truth is that we tend to look at just the most famous people in American history as the founders. But actually, the American founding is the work of many, many great men. There's a scene in 1776 when John Adams complains to Franklin, this is actually based on an actual letter that Adams very insecurely wrote. But in the scene, Adams says to Franklin, he says, Franklin, I won't be in the history books anyway, only you. Franklin did this, and Franklin did that, and Franklin did some other darn thing. Franklin smote the ground, and out sprang George Washington, fully grown and on his horse. Franklin then electrified him with his miraculous lightning rod, and the three of them, Franklin, Washington, and the horse, conducted the entire revolution by themselves. There's a pause, and then Franklin says to Adams, I like it. Okay. Truth is that history, rightly studied, teaches us about the labors of the less famous founders. And if we have Roger Sherman to thank for the Constitution, we have him to thank for Thanksgiving as well. In defending Boudinot's proposal in the House, Sherman cited not civics, but the Bible. And here we find something amazing. Mr. Sherman, the Annals of the Congress, informs us, quote, justify the practice of Thanksgiving on any signal event, not only as a laudable one in itself, but as warranted by a number of precedents and holy writ. For example, the solemn thanksgivings and rejoicings, which took place in the time of Solomon after the building of the temple. This example, he, Roger Sherman, argued, was worthy of imitation, end quote. This argument must have resonated because we are further informed in the Annals that the question was now put upon the resolution and it was carried in the affirmative. The House put Sherman on a committee with senators to go to Washington, ask him to issue a Thanksgiving statement, and Washington did issue the statement urging Americans to gather on November 26th to thank their Creator for, quote, the peaceable and rational manner in which we have been enabled to establish constitutions of government for our safety and happiness, and particularly the national one now instituted for the civil and religious liberty with which we are blessed, end quote. And so the first American Thanksgiving, carried by Roger Sherman, essentially, and his Dvar Torah, was meant to express gratitude for the creation and the ratification of the Constitution. And it was defended in Congress as a parallel to Solomon's Thanksgiving for the creation and dedication of the first Beit HaMikdash, the first temple. Solomon, in other words, is the source of Thanksgiving. And we should have known that a holiday whose only ritual centers on eating a massive meal was a Jewish idea. Jokes aside, Sherman's point is profound. The ritual of giving thanks, he's arguing to those concerned congressmen, this is not a European concept, this is Hebraic. And Sherman, who knew his Bible, understood that the story spoke to the very moment in which America found itself. Solomon's story is known by the Jews as the Chanukat HaBayit, the first dedication of the temple. It was the original Chanukah, which means dedication. His celebration and dedication was, of course, the precedent for Yehuda HaMakabi's rededication of the Second Temple hundreds and hundreds of years later. But unlike the Hasmonean revolt, Solomon's dedication took place at the one time in Jewish history when Israel was a superpower. And now all the enemies of David had been defeated. A magnificent temple of which David had dreamed and designed had been built by Solomon on the Temple Mount. And at this moment, when Solomon stands at the apex of his political power, rather than celebrating himself, he gives thanks to God and dedicates his temple, his family, and his government to divine service. So Sherman, who in the Constitutional Convention had himself favored a weaker executive, is now arguing to the first Congress that if Americans were worried about the power that they had given its new government, then instead of being against a National Day of Thanksgiving, on the contrary, the most reasonable way to approach and to secure the liberties of Americans from tyranny is by imitating Solomon in America and acknowledging that the source of all power lay actually not in the state, but in God. And so a fascinating connection between Jewish texts and Thanksgiving now begins to emerge, one which we often miss out on. A friend of mine, Eric Nelson, who is a professor of government at Harvard, he told me a story that a Jewish colleague of his had asked his son why Jews celebrate Passover. And this Jewish young boy, 5 years old, responded as follows. He said, here's why Jews celebrate Passover. A long time ago, the King of England was very mean to the Jews. So they went across the ocean to America so they could freely practice their religion. And then they met the Indians and had a wonderful meal together. And that's the story of Passover, end quote. Truth is that to appreciate the connection between Hanukkah and Thanksgiving, we have to truly understand the history behind these two concepts. And in comprehending the uniqueness of Jewish ideas, we can actually appreciate their impact on America. Thanksgiving in America was proclaimed by Washington, and it was not about the pilgrims. Rather, it was a Chanukah, a dedication of the new government. It was the day when the President of the United States dedicated the Constitution by thanking God for its ratification. Thanksgiving was a Chanukah for the Constitution, thanks to Roger Sherman. And the point of Thanksgiving is that the more powerful a country becomes, the more might its executive wields, the more a yearly Thanksgiving is necessary, as an annual Chanukah, a yearly dedication of a country to a power far beyond themselves. But here is what Roger Sherman surely did not know. This story of Solomon's Chanukah that he cited as a source for American Thanksgiving is actually read by Jews as the Haftorah on Chanukah when the holiday falls out in such a manner that it covers two weekends and thus has a second Shabbat. And we have to understand why. As described in Malachim in the Book of Kings, Solomon, when seeking to build the temple, reaches out to the ally of his father David, Hiram, king of Tyre in Phoenicia. Solomon informs Hiram that he plans to fulfill his father David's dream of building a temple, but he needed someone skilled in sculpting, metallurgy, craftsmanship to help him accomplish the task. Jew is building, he can't do this on himself, obviously. He needs to hire help to actually build this for him. But he says, V'yata shalach li ish chacham lasot ba'zahav v'kesu v'nachoshet v'ar barzel. Send me somebody who's skilled in metalworking. And King Hiram responds enthusiastically, praising the God who would dwell in Jerusalem. Baruch Adu Shem Elokei Yisrael asher asah et hashamayim v'et haaretz. Blessed is the God of Israel who created the heaven and the earth. And Hiram sent him his most skilled craftsman, who appears to be someone of Israelite lineage, but far up to the north near Tyre, near Phoenicia, and has taken on Phoenician culture because this Jew's name was also Hiram. And it's fascinating then that it's with this story, this Haftarah, that Jews would at times conclude their own Chanukah celebration. Chanukah, after all, recalls a consecration of the temple in a time that was utterly unlike Solomon's age, unlike the age of Solomon. The Judeans fighting in the name of God at the time of the Hasmoneans were not a superpower. They are fighting a civil war with Hellenist Jews that are backed by a non-Jewish empire who sought to destroy the Jewish faith. And yet, when a second Shabbat avails itself during the celebration of the Hasmonean Chanukah, when Jews persecuted throughout the diaspora remembered a ragtag bunch of individuals who fought for Judaism, in a burst of optimism on the second Sabbath, they would read of a very different age, the age of Solomon, when Judaism and Jerusalem inspired not hate but admiration from the world, when its vision not only united members of its own people, but also when our message of the God of the Bible who dwells in Jerusalem inspired not only Jews but great leaders of other nations. And so the very story of Solomon's temple reflects the Jewish faith in the possibility that one day what Jews believed would inspire the world. And it's therefore so striking that in 1789, thousands of years after the advent of Solomon's consecration, of Solomon's Chanukah, the story of that Chanukah was cited by Congress as the source for inaugurating and dedicating the Constitution by which we Americans live today. A Constitution composed by founders that in their own way, through their own deeds, would echo the words of King Hiram of Phoenicia. Blessed be the God of Israel, the creator of heaven and earth. And so we can imagine, therefore, what was going through the mind of my predecessor, Gershom Mendes Satius, when on November 26, 1789, George Washington made his Thanksgiving proclamation. This is a man known as the Patriot Rabbi of the Revolution, who, when the British took New York in the war, fleeing, in one of my favorite phrases from the Synagogue Annals, leading forth a majority of his flock in flight northward over the plains of Harlem and Washington Heights. And after the war, he and his flock returned to New York and to share with Israel. He's offered a salary of 200 pounds a year, plus a yearly supply of firewood. I just want to point out, I get no firewood, okay? A new constitution is approved, a president is inaugurated, and as we now understand, It was precisely in the process of ratifying the Constitution and inaugurating the new president that the uniqueness of America as a home for Jews was made so powerfully manifest. So that even before Washington's Thanksgiving proclamation, it was so obvious to American Jews how thankful they must be, what a gift this new Constitution was, how it facilitated for the first time their ability to be both stranger and neighbor, both Jew and American. Then, meeting essentially down the block from the synagogue, the American Congress, citing the precedent of Solomon's Temple, ordained a day of thanksgiving in honor of the Constitution. Can it be any wonder that what followed was a reverential participation of New York's Jews in this Thanksgiving day? Satius on the day itself organized a Thanksgiving service in the synagogue, which included the recital of Hebrew scriptural songs of praise, and reverently delivered the first Thanksgiving synagogue sermon, the handwritten text of which is displayed outside our sanctuary at Cherith Israel today. Satius in the sermon spoke of our duty to this new government, which was, he says, quote, founded upon the strictest principles of equal liberty and justice. And he added, as we are made equal partakers of every benefit that results from this good government, for which we cannot sufficiently adore the God of our fathers who have manifested his care over us in this particular instance, neither can we demonstrate our sense of his benign goodness for his favorable interposition in behalf of the inhabitants of this land, end quote. Since that day, a special service has been held in Cherith Israel on Thanksgiving, which includes the recitation of passages of Hallel. Also, since Thanksgiving is always on Thursday now, we always get to skip V'hurachum and Tachnun, which is itself cause for giving a whole nother Thanksgiving celebration. And then, of course, after saying Hallel, we proceed to our entrance on Central Park West and watch the Macy's Day Parade, just as Gershom Mendes Satius did in 1789. The week before I was installed in Cherith Israel as the rabbi, and as Gershom Mendes Satius' successor, I went to the archives of the synagogue. I'd gone there, I think, a little bit before, and I actually held the original handwritten text of the sermon delivered by Satius on Thanksgiving Day, 1789. And holding that paper in my hand, I felt the barriers between past and present collapse. And I felt, like the original Jews of America, what it meant to be a link in a chain stretching backward and forward across the centuries. On display here is the original handwritten version of Gershom Mendes Satius's Thanksgiving address delivered in 1789. This was for America's first Thanksgiving because it was the first time that the President of the United States actually proclaimed a national day of giving thanks. And this, of course, was declared by George Washington. So here you have a handwritten sermon that was composed and delivered by the man known as the Patriot Rabbi of the Revolution. And so now, knowing the Jewish history of Thanksgiving, we are able to adopt, I hope, a deeper understanding of what exactly we as American Jews ought to be celebrating on that day. Naftali Phillips, at age 96, recalled in his letter that sometime after the procession, a large sign was set up at some public house in Philadelphia, representing, meaning with pictures, of all Federal Convention members, all being present as they sat with General Washington at their head as their president. And at the lower part of the sign were these words, "These 37 great men together have agreed that better times shall soon succeed." This prediction was not taken for granted by much of American citizenry. But if we do believe that this prophecy of a sort proved correct, then what we mark on Thanksgiving is not merely a moment to express gratitude for our lives, though it is that, but also indeed first and foremost for the Constitution and its freedoms, which not only bless us but obligates us as Jews to be both ger and toshav, to be dedicated Americans, but also better Jews. At a time in the 1780s when it was a much more audacious act, patriotic Jews in 18th century America combined a loyalty to the country with an open observance of kashrut in the public square and an observance of Shiva Asar B'Tammuz. Today, when we are so free to practice our faith, how can we not do likewise? And if we do so, then there is no predicting the impression we might make so that many other Americans can join King Hiram and Roger Sherman and the Congress of the United States in being inspired by Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Asher Asa et Hashamayim, Ve'et Ha'aretz. when I published a piece in the Wall Street Journal about the Jewish story of Thanksgiving and of the history of the congregation. It was published on a Friday in the religion column in the Wall Street Journal, and then immediately after Shabbat, I opened my email and I saw that I had received, this was right before my installation as rabbi, and I received this wonderfully nice email from a Christian. So I received the email. The email went as follows. Good morning, Mr. Soloveitchik. Your wonderful essay on Thanksgiving Day in yesterday's Wall Street Journal made my day. As a devout Irish Catholic in Denver, Colorado, I am a firm believer in religious freedom for all, a huge fan of the Jewish people and the State of Israel. Your essay is historically instructive, emotionally moving, and a pleasant reminder of how gratitude and thanksgiving should be an active part of our daily lives. I count my many blessings daily and give thanks to God for all he has done for me. Your writing underscores how fortunate we are to live in such a welcoming country that allows and encourages our cultural and religious diversity. Today, he writes, today is my wife and my 29th wedding anniversary. So my thoughts of thankfulness and being blessed are many. I'll be thinking about your essay on Thanksgiving itself. Thanks for the wonderful message. I'm sure people around the world have enjoyed it. Best of luck to you in your new position at Sheretz Israel. You'll be an instrument of God's peace and wisdom, compassion and hope. I think he picked the right man for the job. Again, something that no Jew in a synagogue would ever say to the rabbi. Happy Thanksgiving and Hanukkah to you and to your family. Signed, Dennis Smith. Literally the most guyish name possible, right? Signed, Dennis Smith. And then he writes, P.S., time to bring my wife coffee in bed. End quote. We really can inspire people to say, as Hiram said, blessed is the God of Israel, asher asah et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. May our renewed sense of what Thanksgiving is help us make this most American of holidays more meaningful to us as Jews. And may the extraordinary example of America's earliest Jews inspire us not only on Thanksgiving, but throughout our lives. Thank you very much.
Rabbi Soloveitchik, this lecture focused on some of the religious responses to the Constitution, to the ratification debate that occupied the country throughout. The Jewish community came down really on one side of that. Is that what giving thanks meant to the Jewish community, really?
We have to understand that Thanksgiving originally, for Jews and non-Jews, was about celebrating and giving thanks to God for the peaceful way in which this new republic and its form of government had been created. So that's true for Jews and non-Jews. But Jews have a particular reason to be grateful. Because this, as Sacius will say in one of his Thanksgiving proclamations, this is a new government that is founded on the strictest principles of liberty and justice. What he means by that is not the First Amendment. What he means by that is that this is a form of government that does not, at the national level, have a religious test for office. And in fact, it bans any religious test. It bans Congress from setting one up after this Constitution has been started. So it's not only that there's no religious test now, they know Congress can't make one. That means that the Constitution and its authors are saying to America's Jews, you are one of us. You can serve in the legislature like anyone else. And that for them is extraordinary. There's nothing else like that on earth. And that's the cause for profound thanks on their part. That's truly a cause for Hallel.
It's actually a transformative moment in Jewish history that the Jewish people would be invited to be full citizens.
Yes. It's a transformative moment in Jewish history, and it's a transformative moment in American history. Because at the state level, a lot of legislators have religious rules. And there are debates over the next decades over these rules. But ultimately, as historians note, they get dropped in part because it seems silly that the national government has no such tests and indeed bans such tests. So it not only is a watershed moment for Jews in America, it ends up defining the freedom of believers in American public life throughout the entire fabric of American society. So what you see being born in America is civic ritual. Inaugurals, which, as Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has pointed out, viewing them from Britain through British eyes, is really an act of covenantal renewal. And days of thanksgiving, which is in a certain sense a recognition of God as King of America, in contrast to a human king, but also a day for marveling at the prosperity of America and the success of the American experiment. So the fact that Roger Sherman cites this from Hebrew Bible, what he's basically saying it to those who are worried about it is that you're comparing this to the rites of the Church of England with its royal celebrations. Actually, it's the exact opposite. It's Hebraic ritual that celebrates a divine king and the acceptance of his impact and his rule among civic society.
What you've just described, Rabbi Soloveitchik, about the human necessity for ritual and its connection to unifying our nation, that's a lesson for new Jews and non-Jews alike. Are there other things that you think that Jewish viewers should take away from this and that non-Jewish viewers can take away from this early formation of Thanksgiving in America?
The story of America's Thanksgiving will inspire all Americans to better understand this national holiday and the civic rituals that accompany it. Some families do actually still have a tradition of giving thanks at the table. And it's certainly well and good for them to give thanks about what's most blessed in their own lives. But the truth is, even more than July 4th, Thanksgiving is a day of marveling at the miracle of the American Republic and of giving thanks for the freedoms that we enjoy in it. And that, I think, is largely faded. And I'd love for some of that aspect of what Thanksgiving once was to be recovered by American society.
In some ways, when we were studying Thomas Paine and his reliance through Milton on Talmudic ideas relating to kinship and republican government, we were celebrating something which is an incredible instance of human ingenuity, human enterprise, human will, to really found something very new. And turning to this lecture now, again, also drawing inspiration from Jewish ideas, we have a celebration not of human ingenuity, but of the limits of human ingenuity and our need to offer gratitude and thanks for something which is quite a bit more powerful than us. It is interesting that both come from a common source and both recognize two aspects of human nature.
And that's a very insightful point. And of course, as you've mentioned and we've discussed, those two themes are embodied as well in the two seals that were suggested, one which focuses on divine intervention and miracles, and one which focuses on human courage and determination. And even in Washington's own letters to the Jewish community, one letter will focus on the miracles that God did in Egypt and for the American Republic, and one will focus on the contributions that Jews will make as Americans to the American Republic. So just as this is, as Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik has famously noted, this dialectic between human effort and reliance upon the divine is a dialectical thread that runs through the Bible and through all of Jewish tradition. These biblical themes run through the story of the American Republic as well. It's an aspect of American life that many of us are losing today. But these two threads are everywhere in the story of America.
Next on Jewish Ideas and the American Founders, a tale of three letters.